now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Jerry Marzinski, a licensed mental health practitioner specializing in psychiatric care. He is a licensed pilot and scuba diver. He is also an avid explorer of nature and things that go bump in the night. Jerry has a rather extensive resume, and we will have all of his resume information, his credentials listed on the Cosmic Switchboard website, as well as on our dedicated YouTube channel. And we will also have Jerry's dedicated YouTube channel and his Facebook page also listed on YouTube and our website. So we've got a lot of information to go through. Jerry Marzinski is going to share 35 years of his experience in the psychiatric field and what he's learned about what people call schizophrenia. And those of us in our field, we know that the voices people hear, the hallucinatory sounds and what have you, they're more than just voices. They're more than just sounds. They're more than just things that are made up in the minds of these patients, that something much deeper is going on. So Jerry is going to share 35 years of experience in the field, in the trenches, because this is spiritual warfare made manifest in the physical plane. So without any further ado, Jerry Marzinski, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I think I have some very important information to give listeners. I'm glad you've given me the opportunity to do this, because they're not going to find this anywhere else.
Yeah, please let our listeners know your background and how you got into this field and what led you down this path. How did you come to this grim realization that these voices that the psychiatric patients are hearing are not just voices, that there's something very deeper and something somewhat sinister going on?
Well, okay, let me start at the beginning. I think what kicked this off was I was raised with an inherent distrust of authority from the get-go. And so, the higher I got up in the educational system, the less tolerant they were of questions. Then Vietnam came along and Nixon, and that increased my distrust of authority even more. When I went to Temple University, I hit abnormal psychology. I was just absolutely fascinated with it. One thing I saw was that they gave a lot of descriptions of different mental illnesses, but they had no solutions other than drugs. They said schizophrenics were hallucinating. They didn't go into any details about what those hallucinations were. They said they were out of touch with reality. What I hated about undergraduate psych was you did not have access to a clinical population. And for somebody who doesn't trust authority, that didn't go over very well. I had to trust it. Everything they said, unlike engineers and other people who can go into a lab and see and experience what they're talking about, I couldn't do that. So with that, with trust, I looked at a lot of the authors and went to the references. And then you go to the references, and this guy references this guy, who references this guy, who references this guy. And it reminded me when I was scuba diving of this little community of fish. They stuck their heads out of these little holes in the bottom of the ocean. They had a little pile of rocks around them. And when one left, another one would jump out and steal one of his rocks and go back. It seemed like that's what they were doing there. They would take somebody else's information. There was very little firsthand stuff. And you trace it back. And a lot of them didn't have a lot of firsthand clinical experience. It was all academic stuff. So, there wasn't any hard science. Then one day we were assigned a reading assignment, and it was a psychologist who wrote this, and it stuck in my mind because it said two delusional patients with the same delusion who meet each other, one of them would have to give up their delusion and take on another one. And I'm like, what kind of sense does that make? You got two crazy people there. Why is one going to give up his delusion because this other guy has the same delusion? It stuck in my mind. I put it in my back memory. After graduate school, around 1975, I was hired onto Central State Hospital in Millfield, Georgia. It was the biggest psychiatric hospital in the world. 2,000 acres, 13,000 patients at one point. It was built right after the Civil War, and it served as a mental hospital, a prison, an old folks' home, asylum. I mean, it was huge. It was massive. Every form of mental illness there was possible. So back to the why did one give up, you know, his delusion. So one day I was walking down one of the psychiatric units, and a new guy came on the unit, and I saw he was pacing, and he was talking to himself, and I kind of walked up to him and asked him, hey, you must have just got here. What's your name? And he looks at me and he goes, I'm Jesus Christ. And I go, oh, okay. And I thought back to what I was told in undergraduate school about if two people had the same delusion, one of them would have to give way. So I looked him in the eye and I said, no, I'm Jesus Christ. And I waited for his response. You know, I'm going, okay, let's see what happens here. And he looks at me and he's puzzled and he goes, okay, we can both be Jesus Christ. And then he walks away. I'm going, okay, if they lied to me about that, you know, what else are they lying to me about? So, I mean, my suspicion went up even higher. So, when I got to Central State, I mean, it was built in 1842 and it was called the Georgia Lunatic Asylum. One of the first things I noticed that was strange was the high assault rate on psychiatrists by psychotic patients. And I'm kind of like, you know, what's going on with that? And why are these guys getting beat up more than any other staff? So, you know, it seemed like there was some kind of bad blood between them and the psychotic patients. So I kind of looked into it. I mean, they had something called the central kitchen there where all the staff would get together and you'd hear tales of what happened on the different units. And there was always some psychiatrist that was getting beat up. So I looked into it, and the research showed that for custodial staff, these are staff that are around psychiatric patients 24 hours a day, all the time, you know, and many more of them than there are psychiatrists. Their rate of being assaulted was 68.2 per 1,000 psych patients. No, that was a psychiatrist rate. They were assaulted at a rate of 68.2 per 1,000 patients. The custodial staff were assaulted at 69 times per 1,000 patients. You know, the difference is the psychiatrist might see 20 patients a day for 15 minutes. And the psych staff, the custodial staff, were running 24 hours a day constantly, hundreds of them. So that was strange. Why are they being assaulted? You know, it's like something was wrong there. I didn't know what it was. And then one day I got a call from another counselor in another unit. And he goes, hey, you got to come over here and see this. Now, he had a psychiatrist over there we called Dr. Freud. I mean, the state hospital didn't have the highest, you know, the best psychiatrist around. A lot of them were, you know, Cubans and other people that couldn't find jobs in other hospitals. So this guy, we called him Dr. Freud because he walked around with a suit. He had a beard and a mustache like Freud. He acted like Freud, you know, and he was kind of bizarre, but he was a psychiatrist. And then Ed calls me up and he goes, hey, man, you got to see this. Get over here. So what happened? I went over there and we went into the psychiatrist's office, and right in the middle of his desk was a pile of feces that was shaped into a pipe. This guy smoked a pipe. And one of the psychotic guys who was his patient snuck in there at like 2-3 in the morning. So he had to go down like 2 or 3 flights of stairs to get to this guy's office. Now, one of the things they told us in graduate school is, psychotic patients are too disorganized to do any kind of advanced planning. You know, they're just all over the place. They're in another world. They're just too whacked out to plan and carry out anything. So I'm looking at this. This patient had to go down 3 flights of stairs, past 3 attendant stations that were manned, somehow break into this psychiatrist's office. And then he got out the window and he escaped, leaving that pile of feces shaped into a pipe.
Sorry, I can't help but laugh. Pretty creative, if you ask me.
Too. But you know, that was another one. It's like, okay, so they're telling me these guys don't have any advanced planning. So, you know, as this stuff mounted up, it's like, you know, what are they telling me in the ivory tower? It just doesn't match up to what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing. The next thing I noticed that was pretty bizarre was the psychotics, the schizophrenics, kept going off their medications. And it was the only thing that was keeping them sane. It was the only bridge to sanity they had. And they kept going off, you know, at a higher rate than almost any of the others except for the bipolars. And the bipolars, like the they like that manic high they got off of going off of their meds. So it was like, why are these guys choosing to go insane? You know, going off their meds, and it's not like they did it once or twice. I mean, it would happen constantly. It was a major problem. They were going off their meds all over the hospital. And, you know, it's like, why? And none of the staff seemed concerned about it. So I started asking them, you know, what's going on? Why are they choosing to go psychotic? Why are they not taking their medications? And I remember some of the answers. It was like, oh, that's just a symptom of their illness. Yeah, okay. And the most reasonable one I got from the psych nurse was, well, they don't like the side effects. That made sense. The side effects aren't great. They're pretty bad. Impotence. You feel like crap. You feel drugged up. There's a lot of bad side effects, but none of them come anywhere near living in a psychotic state, which is about as close to hell as you can get on the planet. So it made no sense why they were doing this. In a psychotic state, there's nightmares. And voices are telling you to kill yourself. They're telling you you're ugly, you're stupid. Everybody's against you. Kill yourself. I mean, it's horrible. It's just horrible. They're paranoid. I mean, there's nothing worse than other than war that I could think of. You know, psychosis is awful. So I ran into a dead end with staff. And I didn't get any reasonable answers about why that was happening other than side effects. So I began asking patients, and they said the same thing. We hate the side effects. And so I'm going, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So I got a listing of all the psychiatric symptoms of schizophrenia. And then I sat down every single patient that went off their meds, and I said, okay, write down all the side effects you experienced. I mean, there were a handful. They weren't good. You know, they weren't terrible, but they weren't good. They were, you know. And then I gave them that list of psychiatric symptoms from schizophrenia. I said, well, which one of these have you experienced? And they'd circle a whole bunch of them, and they were awful. And then I gave them the two lists, and I said, which is worse? 100%. They said, well, the psych symptoms are worse. The psychotic symptoms are worse. We go, well, then why do you keep going off your medications? You know what they said? I don't know. One after another, scores of them, didn't know. They just didn't know. So I kept asking. I kept, you know, over and over, I kept asking. And the asking went on for maybe a year, 2 years. You know, I felt like a crazy guy asking the same question over and over again and expecting a different response until one day I got a different response. There was a girl who went off her meds. She was about to get kicked out of the psych rehab center we worked for. Her mother was there, and both of us were imploring her. You know, why? You were doing great in your classes. She was going to cosmetology classes. We go, why did you go off your meds again? And she said, the voices told me to. And I'm like, what? They told me to. And so the voices told you to go off your meds. Yeah. Okay. So I logged that in, and then as other psychiatric patients came up, I would ask them when they went off their meds, did the voices have anything to do with you going off your meds? Some of them said straight up, yeah, they did. They told me I was being poisoned by the psychiatrist. And I'd heard that a million times, you know, hey, they're poisoning me. The psychiatrists are poisoning me. These medicines are poison. And then I went, yeah, that ties into why they're getting beat up so much. So there were two things going on there. Even though there wasn't a 100% response with the patient saying, yeah, the voices are directly telling me to not take the meds, there was always that thought that they were being poisoned, that the meds were bad, and their attention was drawn away from the psychotic symptoms and what it was like to be psychotic, the horror of that, and focused all on the side effects of the medications until they were convinced that they had to go off the medications. And one after another, they did that, they did that, they did that, they did that. So, I mean, here's 100% of my brain, you know, the psychotic symptoms are worse. So it's like, you know, what's going on here? I mean, it didn't make any sense. You know, their memory was being erased of what the psychotic symptoms were like. So at that point, I figured, well, I need to know more about these voices. So I started asking them questions. What are they? What are they telling you? What are they doing? And the first thing I ran into was massive resistance. They didn't want to talk about those voices. That took probably 2 years to figure out what was going on. The bottom line was there is no positive benefit to them talking about the voices. None. You know, they get drugged up by psychiatrists. They get accused of being possessed. Their friends think they're weird. Their family thinks they're weird. The voices are telling them horrible things about themselves. There is no positive outcome to them talking about the voices. And they learned this the hard way. So then it became a matter of trying to get them to trust me, a psych, and one of the people that were responsible for drugging them out of their minds or having them sent to the psychiatrist. So bit by bit, they started telling me about them. But what I noticed that if they sensed in any way that I believed that the voices were strictly hallucinations, they would shut up. I wouldn't get anything out of them. Nothing. They would just shut up. Now, if they saw that I was giving them either the benefit of the doubt and earnestly asking questions, they would give me a little bit of information, you know, but they'd get anxious about it. And I was like, well, why are they getting anxious about telling me about the voices? But it was a pretty consistent phenomenon. So I get bits and pieces. One of the things I learned was that the voices are consistently negative. Always negative. They're always saying bad things. So they're always putting the person down. They're telling them to do stuff to get them in trouble. Don't take your meds. Don't go to class. It was all consistently negative. There wasn't anything positive in it. So here's psychiatry saying, well, these are hallucinations. Well, hallucinations are random. You know, they're as random as the person. They're good. They're bad. They're neutral. They're all over the place. These things are consistently negative. They're running consistent negative patterns, you know. And you try to talk to psychiatry about that. Get out of my face. You know, some of the patients got upset when I was asking them about the voices, and that hit psychiatry one day. And I don't know how many times I was told by psychiatrists, don't ask them about their hallucinations. What it does is it reinforces them and makes them worse, and it makes the patient worse. You know, all you're doing is causing more damage. But, you know, at that point I was going, well, something's fishy here. And, you know, they threatened me a couple of times. You keep doing this, you're upsetting my patients. You know, stop it. They ordered me to stop it.
Just to clarify, Jerry, those are psychiatrists telling you that. What was your position relative to the psychiatrist, and what was your position within that particular system?
What I was a what they call a psychiatric counselor. And working for the Yarborough Rehabilitation Center, which was a psychiatric rehabilitation center. Right, so our job was to get these people stabilized, find them a job, keep them on their meds, and then get them out to the community working with their families. Problem is, they wouldn't stay on their meds. You know? So in order to get that goal accomplished, had to find out why they weren't staying on their meds. And it wasn't just there. It was all over the hospital. You know? And it was just accepted. Oh, that's just what they do. They're crazy. You know, that's what they do. So, you know, I was a master's level counselor at that time. You know, I graduated from Temple University and then got my master's degree at the University of Georgia and then was hired at Central State Hospital at the Psychiatric Rehab Center. So, you know, I had to be real careful with psychiatry because, you know, I didn't know why the patients were getting upset when I asked them about the voices. I mean, but it was a consistent phenomenon. So that was something in the back of my mind. Well, what's going on with this? So, you know, I finally realized, like I said, there's no positive outcome to them talking about them. You know, if they say, hey, the voices are telling me to kill myself, see, that's another thing with psychiatry. They say, oh, yeah, these are hallucinations. They're just meaningless hallucinations. But if they found out that the voices were telling the patient that they were to kill themselves, they jumped like somebody poked them with a hot poker. You know, they jammed, put them on suicide watch, filled them full of drugs. You know, all of a sudden they became very real. You know, I'm like, oh, okay. On one hand, they're hallucinating. On the other hand, these guys are treating them like they're, you know, deadly, and they are deadly. And so here's a schizophrenic thing I'm watching going on with psychiatry. So slowly, bit by bit, I got little pieces of information about the voices. And each time I got one, if I gave it to a new patient and they saw that I understood, they were more willing to give me more information. You know? So the more information I had, the easier it was to draw them out. So I was collecting little by little, you know, time after time I was being yelled at by psychiatry, you're upsetting our patients, stop asking them questions about the voices you're doing, couldn't be making them worse. And then one day I noticed another strange thing is on the ward that they had church services where they had ice cream socials. They go to church and they go to the ice cream social, they get ice cream, they get cake, stuff they didn't get in the state hospital often. So that was like, you know, for any of them that were half sane, they loved that. They wanted to go there. They'd go to church even if they didn't like it, you know, just to get the ice cream and stuff. But I noticed all the schizophrenics stayed behind. They stayed on the dingy wards. And I'm like, you know, what's with that? You know, and, you know, so I started asking questions about that. And they said, well, you know, when I go to church, the voices get louder. I'm like, what? Yeah, they get louder. And what do they tell you? Well, they say this is full of crap. This is garbage. You know, stay out. Don't go to church. It's, you know, one of them I remember saying the voices told him Jesus Christ couldn't even save himself. What makes you think he's going to save you? You know, and I'm like, the voices are telling him that?
That's a coherent statement. It's not some jumbled kind of like a fusion of misdirected thoughts.
No, not at all. You know, so and that was consistent. So what? As I asked more questions, I mean, I asked scores of patients after that. You know, what happens when you go to church? What happens when you read the Bible? Because some of them intuitively knew that if they read the Bible, these things got upset. I didn't know that. They told me that. And they said, well, I tried to read the Bible. The voices get all upset. They say it's a bunch of garbage. You know, and then they say, and this was fairly consistent too, if the patient would refuse to stop reading the Bible, the voices would tell them, okay, well, then you've got to read it from cover to cover. And they went, oh, okay, we'll compromise with the voice. Well, I'll start reading in the beginning. So they get to the point where this guy begat that guy, begat that guy, begat that guy. And that goes on for like 30 pages or what, I don't know what section of it is. And then the voices come back and go, see, it's a bunch of crap. Why are you reading this? And the patient goes, well, yeah, it's a bunch of crap. I don't know why I'm reading this. Put it away. So I went, wow, that's interesting. So that effectively stopped them from reading the Bible. And then with church, I'd ask them, you know, what happens when you go to church? There were three categories. You know, depending on how strong their voices were, if the voices weren't very strong, they'd tell them, don't go, you know, and give them all kinds of stuff. That, you know, you're wasting your time, don't go. Once they got into the church, the voices shut up if they weren't very strong. There were those that were so strong that when the patient got into the church, they panicked. They actually jumped up and ran out of the church for no apparent reason. Then there was those with the moderate strength voices who would sit there and they'd try to listen, but the voices would be screaming so loud they couldn't concentrate or hear anything that the preacher was saying. And I'm like, a hallucination is doing this? You know, and it was consistent. So here's another consistency. You know, why is a hallucination telling these people not to read the Bible, not to go to church? As a matter of fact, they couldn't read anything positive, spiritual, without the voices acting up. And like, well, that's odd. That's a hallucination. That doesn't make any sense. So then the next thing I noticed was that a lot of the schizophrenic patients had books that they were reading. They weren't the Bible. What they were murder mysteries and horror stories.
Oh.
To their counter. And I'm like, a lot of them had it. But, and I'm like, as I walked through the rooms, I'm like, what are you reading that for? You know, it's horrible stuff. You know, it was consistent. And they were able to sit down and they were able to repeat, you know, big sections of what those horror stories were. And I found that odd. So, you know, they try to read the Bible. They can't remember anything of what they read. But yet they read horror stories and they can remember pages. And so I started experimenting with that. And I got a paragraph from a spiritual, positive spiritual book. And I got a paragraph from one of their horror stories. And I said, okay, read this one and write down everything you remember. Okay, now read this section of the Bible or some other spiritual thing and write down everything. They remembered everything about the horror story. They didn't remember anything about the spiritual stuff. I'm like, okay, what's with that? You know, that's odd. So it was consistent also. By the time I'd left Central State, I was, I'd been warned several times not to be asking patients about their voices. And Central State was Proposition 13 hit, and they were closing down the hospital. It's the biggest psychiatric hospital in the world. They're closing it down. So I applied to a PhD program and got accepted into one of the best in the country and left Central State for 2 years in a PhD program. And you know, I was so disillusioned, I couldn't tell you. You know, one of the first things I saw was the head of the department got us all together and was teaching us how to lie with statistics. You know, and I'm looking, what he was doing was describing the last 5% of a population as if it were a separate population that didn't belong to the entire normal curve. You know, by then I'd had several statistics courses. I wasn't the best statistician in the world by a long shot. But I raised my hand and I said, hey, and this was the head of the department. I said, well, wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand what you're saying here. I said, you're describing this 5% segment as if it's a separate population, not belonging to the entire population. And he goes, that's exactly right. And said, well, you know, how can you do that? And I'll never forget his answer. He said, well, if the people reading my article aren't smart enough to understand statistics enough to catch this, that's their problem. And I was like, my head just went boom. You know, and I'm like staring at him in shock. And I look around at all the other students in the room, and they're like, oh, yeah, okay, so that's how the game's played. And there was one guy, Tom, I looked at him, and he just kind of looked at me and like shook his head and then looked straight ahead before we got caught, you know. So it was like, what is going on here? You know? So, you know, that was the first thing that blew my mind. And there was another one where I was working as a teaching assistant with master's level students and running groups with them. And it was a winter night. It was in Iowa, and it was just freezing cold. There was a snowstorm. So, you know, I went to work anyway. And running the group, it was going pretty well. And then the professor who hired me comes in and he goes, I want to sit in one of your groups. Okay, going good. Come on in. And a student asked me a question that I didn't know the answer to. So I was honest. I said, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. So after group, he shuffled everybody out. He goes, I want to see you. Come in my office. Come on, I want to see you. And I sat down and he goes, don't you ever tell a student you don't know something. You know, don't you ever do that again. And I'm like, what? Well, wait a minute. I didn't know the answer to his question. Don't you ever tell them that. You know, and I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do? Well, you know, tell them you'll find out and then come back with something. Wow. What's going on here? Another thing with publishing. I mean, there was one thing where, you know, they wanted us to do a research article and publish anything. It didn't matter what it was. So, I mean, it was thing after thing after thing like this. And slowly I felt like I was being brainwashed. You know, it was like, wait a minute. They're telling me how to think. They're telling me how to act. I mean, it was like, I got to the point where I got so depressed. I said, I can't take this anymore. I left there after 2 years with close to an A average. And it felt like, you know, some kind of mental boot camp where they put you in this pressure cooker and they were turning up the heat to make you think the way they wanted you to think You know, and heaven forbid if you asked any questions or challenged them, which is something I always did, and I was always in trouble for it. So finally I went, I can't do this anymore. So I left there and moved to Tucson, where I worked for La Frontera Mental Health Center for 2 years. I taught abnormal psychology in the community college, and then a position opened up in the psychology prison of the state, or the psychology department of the state prison. So I interviewed for that. I knew some people out there, and I was hired into the psych department at the prison. And the prison at that point was starting to turn into the state hospital. So here they are closing state hospitals all across the nation. So those guys had, you know, they couldn't work. They couldn't, they weren't taking their meds. They were out there committing crimes. That's the only thing they could do to stay alive. They were getting thrown in prison. So here you have psychotic guys being brutalized in prison. And when their term's up, then they release them still psychotic, but in a much more agitated state. I'm watching this go on, it's like, oh, Jesus. So, but one thing about prison was that, you know, they weren't as sensitive as, you know, the state hospital. The prisoners were always complaining about something. The staff thought all prisoners were liars. You know, you couldn't trust them with anything, and they just became used to prisoners griping and moaning and complaining and lying about stuff. So when I started asking prisoners about their voices, you know, even though they got a little bit upset, that was kind of like, you know, a little blip in the background noise. You know, it wasn't like working for the mental health center or the state hospital where, you know, if they noticed the patient got upset, I mean, everybody in there was upset. You know, so I could get away with asking questions. But the difficult part was gaining their trust. So, you know, they didn't trust staff, and especially they didn't trust psych. And what I would choose would be patients who were willing to talk to me about their voices. So the ones who were willing to tell me what their voices were saying were the ones that I spent the most time with. I had to, you know, there's other duties I had to carry out, but I had pretty much freedom to work with who I wanted. And I ran into this one patient early, we'll call him, you know, inmate Garland. He was a stockbroker in New York, and he was rich. He had a mansion. He had lots of money. He was married, but he kept using cocaine, you know, massive, massive amounts of cocaine until he started hearing voices. I mean, lost his job. His marriage was on the rocks, and the voices hated his wife. And so here he's telling me this, and I'm like, didn't your wife ever find out you were hearing voices? And he goes, no, I hid it. He hid it from his wife for years. And he said, sometimes she caught me in the garage talking to myself, but I just told her I was talking to myself. So she never knew. So at one point, she said, well, I've had it, I'm divorcing you. And he was kind of like relieved. And when she saw that, she was furious. So she just took him to the cleaners. He ended up on the street, psychotic, eating out of garbage cans. And he preferred that. That's what he liked. He was living in Central Park in some hole somewhere. He knew the restaurants to go eat out of the garbage cans. And he liked that. You know, it's like, well, wow. You know, like, I said, are you wanting to get rid of these voices? And he goes, well, yeah, I think so. So after about 6 months, when they, I was telling them to do the opposite of what the voices were telling him. Move on a spiritual path. Don't listen. You know, what they're telling you is, you know, a bunch of crap. And encouraging them to move in a more positive direction and disregard what they're saying. And one day he's sitting in my office, and he all of a sudden he just goes into a stunned look and almost falls out of his chair. And I said, what happened? And he said, they left. And he said they screamed when they left. They're gone. And he said the silence is deafening. And he couldn't even walk. That's how disoriented he was after that. You know, so I went, okay, well, great. You know, they're gone. He said that he's never had a silent mind before. So I figured, okay, this guy's cured. So he was working in the auto section where he was taking calls for the State Department of Transportation, and I lost track of him. One day I went over there to check on him. I said, well, you know, how are you doing? And he goes, I'm doing good. I said, well, how are the voices? He said, I asked for him to come back. I said, what? He said, yeah, I asked for him to come back. He said, I was lonely.
Oh, jeez.
Talk to. So here he is, you know, here he is psychotic. I mean, you know. And then he told me the tale of one phone call where the person who was calling him was psychotic and talking to his voices. And here's him picking up the phone with his voices. You know, that was like, I can't believe he did that. You know, but he did that. So then, you know, that the stories got more and more interesting. There was another one, we'll call him Sparter. This guy was using amphetamine and cocaine. He went psychotic. But he was willing to tell me everything his voices told him. And he told me this story, which I found fascinating. He said one day he was in San Diego. He was hearing voices, and the voices told him, go get two burlap bags. You know, we know where there's some marijuana. You know, take your $250 that he had. And he said, we'll tell you where it is. It's up in Oregon. So he gets two burlap bags, takes his money, and he's listening to where these voices are telling him to go, all the way up to Oregon, from San Diego all the way up to Oregon. He ends up at the base of a mountain at a dead-end road, and then he asks the voices, well, okay, what now? There's no more road. He said, there's a hiking trail to the left. Take your two burlap bags and hit up that trail. So he did. He said 4 hours later, he ran into this giant sesamelia pot field.
Wow.
So he fills up the two bags, and he goes, well, okay, what now? And they said, well, we know a place where you can sell them. There's a park down in near the Columbia River, I think it was. And they told him where to go sell it. So he's down there in the park. He's selling dope, making a fortune off of the stolen dope. And I said, well, what'd you do with all the money? He said, well, I bought all the prostitutes I could handle. I bought all the liquor I could handle. Bought all the drugs I can handle. And he said the voices were fishermen. They wanted to go fishing. I'm like, they wanted a what? He said, yeah, they wanted to go fishing. So I got a fishing pole, and me and the voices went fishing. He said they told me where to throw the hook, you know, where to move, when to go. You know, he said he was the only one on the river that day catching anything. And I'm like, holy macaroni. And so he did that for a month or two. And then he said one day he was about, you know, he ran out of money. He was about to go back up there to get more marijuana to sell. And the voices said, no, don't go up there. They're waiting for you. If you go up there, they'll kill you. They're waiting for you. And he said, take your money, you know, take what dope you have left and go back to San Diego. So he did. He had more money when he left than when he went up there. So I'm like, well, that's an interesting story. When he told me that, he was no longer psychotic. So I worked with him for months. He got rid of his voices, and he told me that story. And I'm looking at him like, you know, you're pulling my leg. You know? Another thing he told me once were the voices told him that to watch out for a certain guy on the yard, a certain inmate. So this other inmate came by, and they said, hey, watch out for this guy. He's going to assault you. So, you know, this guy took a look at him, and then and remember that. He was in the bathroom one day, and he just took a shower, and he was combing his hair back. His hair was soaking wet. So he was flipping it back, and this guy that the voices told him about walked through the door right in back of him just as he flipped that water and hit the guy in the face with it, and the guy attacked him. So these things know ahead of time, or were they in control of this other guy? What was going on here? You know, but it happened.
It bespeaks like a knowledge of geography, a knowledge of the behaviors or potential behaviors of other people. They warn the guy about going back to steal more pot because they'd be waiting for him. So, and it opens up a whole can of worms because it begs the question, well, what about all these spirit guides? And what about these New Agers? And they're getting all this insight about doing this, that, or the other from their guides. It's like, ultimately, where is the source of some of this? Where is it coming from?
That's the $64,000 question. You know, so where do thoughts come from? And I asked that to the head of the PhD department one day. He brought us into another lecture, and after he got done talking, he said, does anybody have any questions? And I raised my hand, and I looked at him, and I said, where do thoughts come from? That's the thing I wanted to get out of that program. And he looked at me like I fell out of a spaceship. It was like I asked him, where does a candle go when you blow it out? And he's up there, and you know, asking a professor a question that stuns him and he can't answer. I was on his shit list immediately. So he said, come up after group and we'll talk. So, you know, went to walk up there and he bolted out of the room. I went, uh-oh, you know, here I go again. Yeah, they know stuff. There was another one. I could go on with stories. They knew stuff that they shouldn't have known.
Yeah, please continue.
There was one where a psychotic inmate was telling me that the voices would tell him which houses to hit and when and about where the loot was. Not exactly, but the general area. You know, and he was telling me all the money he made robbing people and how long he got away with it. And he got away with it for years. And I looked at him and said, well, you know, okay, if they were so good about telling you these things, what are you doing here in prison? And he said, well, I got greedy one day and I didn't listen to him. You know, I went and I hit a house that they told me not to, and I got caught. And one of the stories he told me was when he broke into a house, the voices said, okay, go in this house. The people were in there. You know, it was at night. There was a man and his wife in there. He crawled in the window. They told him about where the jewelry was, and he found it. And then they told him, hey, the man's up, get out of the house. So he jumps out the window, and he starts running down an alley. The voices said, no, don't go down there. The cops are coming up that alley. He said, go in this trash bin here and hide in the trash bin and wait till, you know, just wait. So he did that, and he's in the trash bin, and this cop walks by with a flashlight right next to the trash bin. And as soon as he passes, the voices go, okay, now get out and run. You know, go this other way. And he goes, well, they just passed. They're just, you know, 10, 15 feet away. And he said, no, go run. Go now. So he does. He gets out, closes the lid quietly, and he runs, gets back to his apartment. But he left the loot in the garbage can. Mm. So they're congratulating him. Ah, good job. You did a great job. And he goes, well, I didn't do too great a job. I left, I left all the jewelry in the trash can. They said, well, you can go back and get it in the morning. I'm like, whoa. So, yeah, that was another one. Another one is them telling, you know, I mean, especially with amphetamine addicts, they will tell the amphetamine addict where to be, when to be there, when they're out of drugs, and somebody, some stranger, will walk up with more amphetamine.
Yes, there's a hive consciousness at work where it seems that these spirits, these interdimensional entities, call them what you will, seem to be able to plug into the minds and the information field of all these other people who are similarly under their malign influence. And they seemingly have this ability to move people around almost on a cosmic chessboard, Jerry.
Yeah, I think to some extent you're right. I'm seeing all this, and it's like, holy cow, how does this work? You know, there was story after story of what these things were telling these inmates to do. And then one day I noticed another strange thing in the prison is after the voices attacked these people, they didn't have any energy. You know, so after the voices came screaming and they left, these guys were drained. You know, and for years I thought that was due to the anxiety because they don't say anything good. You're no good. You're rotten. You're worthless. You kill yourself. I mean, nothing good. I mean, it's, you know, just they generate as much fear and anxiety as they possibly can. So I was thinking, well, maybe that's why these guys are drained, because of the anxiety. And I always got assigned to the toughest units out in prison. I mean, the high security. And then one day they assigned me to the jail for the prison, which is the jail for the worst of everybody in the prison was there. One day, this was interesting. One day I get two, they call them inmate kites, inmate letters. One came in the jail. They had two people in a cell there. One letter came in from a psychotic prisoner who was hearing voices. And he was going, I need help. You know, I can't do this anymore. Another one came in from his roommate who the gangsters were trying to kill because he snitched them off in a drug deal. They wanted him dead so bad that they'd already stabbed him once. He couldn't come out of his cell without guards being around him. They were shooting notes under his door saying, as soon as you come out of there, we're going to kill you. Some of them went on purpose to get in trouble, to get thrown into jail so they could get a chance to kill him. You know, nobody could be under more stress than that. And on top of that, this psychotic inmate, who was really psychotic, would stand there at 3 or 4 in the morning and just stand there and look down at him while he was asleep. You know? So it was like, you couldn't be under much more stress than this guy. So I went over there to see them, and I watched the first guy that the gangsters were trying to kill walk up the staircase. He looked like Superman compared to the psychotic guy when he came out of the cell. He could barely make it up the staircase. You know, he didn't have any energy whatsoever. So, you know, I'm thinking, why is a psychotic guy barely able to move, and here's this guy they're trying to kill? I mean, he looks like Superman. So my anxiety theory was out. It was out. So that wasn't it anymore. So then the opposite of that I found, you know, and that was a consistent thing. When the voices attacked, these people were drained. And it's like, okay, where'd the energy go? Why are they drained? Now the opposite of that was one day I met a devil worshiper in the prison, and he was spooky. This guy scared me. And he said he could travel spiritually to cells in another prison 150 miles away, Florence, and he could see what certain inmates were doing in that cell. But he had a lot more energy than most psychotic patients, and he told me some of the awful stuff they did with the devil worshiper stuff. Oh, it was awful. I mean, this guy was spooky. But one thing I was curious about, he had a lot more energy than most of the other psychotic patients I worked with. So I up and asked him, I said, you know, where do you get your energy? I mean, you're not drained like the other schizophrenic patients I work with. And every time I've seen you, you've had plenty of energy. You don't ever seem to be real depressed. And he said, they give it to me. And I said, who gives it to you? They give it to me. And so the dark entities gave it to me. And I said, what do they give it to you for? Well, they give it to me to carry out certain tasks. That's interesting. So I'm like, okay, and log that one in. And one day I show up at CDU, the central detention, the jail, and here I met one of the Kickstarter guards. I mean, he's one of the guys that he likes to rile up the inmates and you know, get in fights with them and stuff. He just said, there's some of them in there. That's what they live off. They're picking these guys and getting these guys riled up. So he just got back from Florence, one of the big maximum detention units there. And another fella was also there. Both these guys were there. I didn't see this myself, but I talked to both these guys separately, and they had the same story. There was a psychotic prisoner in the main prison in Florence, in the high security unit, that they wanted to move to another cell. And this guy was, you know, 190 pounds of pure muscle. I mean, he was a big, you know. And they ordered him. They said, you know, okay, you need to move to another cell. This guy goes, no, I'm not moving anywhere. No, you need to move to another cell. I'm not going anywhere. He said, okay, you know, we're going to go get the pepper spray. You know, now, come on, you know, move to the other cell. He goes, no, I'm not going anywhere. So they get these quart cans of pepper spray. I mean, that's nasty stuff. It's really nasty stuff. And they go up to the cell, like, okay, last chance. He has a towel, he puts it around his head, and they just spray quarts of that stuff in the cell. They were suffering. Their eyes were watering, you know, from that. And the guy is standing there, and he's covered in the pepper spray, and his eyes are watering, and he's beet red. And he still refuses to come out. You know, and they say, okay, come on, now get out. We're going to move you. See, they could have cut off the guy's water and stopped feeding him. Eventually, he would have come out of it. But no, they have to do this confrontational stuff. So he refuses to come out after, you know, a couple of quarts of pepper spray. And they're like, wow, man. So they said, okay, you come out of there, we're going to go get the stun guns. So he goes, you know, screw you, man. You know, come in and get me. Nobody was going to do that at that point. So they come in with two stun guns, 50,000 volts each. And these are the things that they shoot the barb into you and the wire follows, and then they give you 1,000 shot bullets. You know, most inmates, I mean, you hit them with that, and that they're down. I mean, they're down. Even big ones, they're down. So this guy's standing there, and they warn him, come on out now, or we're gonna get you. Yeah, screw you, come in and get me, a bunch of pricks. And they're cussing him. So they shoot him with two of those things. You know, 50,000 volts, and he's just standing there. He's just shuddering, one after the other. As one charges up, the other one's discharging. And then when that one charges, they so, you know, bam, 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 bam. 11 times they hit him, and the guy's just standing there, quivering. He didn't go down.
Shoot.
And the warden's out there, and by then, here's like 20 guards out there, and they're all watching this. And the warden goes, "Hey, man, I'm gonna get nailed for cruel and unusual punishment. I want you guys to stop this." So they stop. They pull out the electrodes. So they go, "Okay, you come on the hell out of there, or we're gonna get the dog." Now, the inmates hate the dog. They're terrified of the dog because those dogs are trained attack dogs, and they grab onto you, and they just bite down to the bone. And this guy wasn't fazed by either of those two things, so he goes, you know, screw your dog. So they got the dog handler, the dog, and then they open the cell wide enough for the dog to go in, and the dog leaps on this guy who's sitting on his bed, and he throws up his arm in front of him like this, and the dog clamps onto his arm. Bites down to the bone, and blood is gushing out of his arm. The dog starts pulling him out. He pulls the dog back while the dog's clamped to his arm, and he looks the dog in the eye, and he goes, "Sit." And the dog sits, but it doesn't let go of his arm. It's still on his arm, and the teeth are already still down to the bone, but it sits. So the dog handler is like, "What the hell is going on in there?" So the dog handler and a bunch of guards grab the leash, and they pull the inmate out of the cell attached to the dog. So they pull the dog out, and the dog's got the inmate. They bring him out, and they beat the shit out of him, and then they move him. So these guys are supernaturally strong when they get, you know, upset. So the guards learned you don't mess with psychotic prisoners. I mean, you know, I've seen one little, you know, couldn't have been more than 100 pounds, throw three big guards around the inside of a cell like they were popcorn. And so where are they getting this energy? You know, I mean, that was supernatural what that guy did. I mean, you know, it's like, holy cow.
Yeah, so, it's amazing that this dynamic is at work. And there's a Kafkaesque element to what you described, Jerry, because in the psychiatric, you know, training schools, they have this priesthood where you're not supposed to question all this stuff, thoughts, you know, where do they come from, taboo, right? Okay. And then they're trying to apply that logic, if you want to call it that, to dealing with these patients. It's very much like cramming a square peg into a round hole. And then you tell me they're shutting down all these psych hospitals all over the place. Inevitably, a lot of those psych patients wind up in the prison population, and they eventually get released into society. The prisons are a finishing school for criminal behavior. I mean, it's just like a Kafkaesque way of turning loose hordes of these untreated and, quite frankly, entity-infested people into society where they just run amok.
Exactly. It's a graduate school for criminal psychotics. I've seen them release inmates from that prison who were psychotic, and I knew would kill somebody within 6 months. I mean, I just knew it. But their time was up, right? They served their time, so they go. And what was so insane about it is that if an inmate escapes from the prison, all right, and it doesn't have to be a psychotic inmate, just any inmate, and you know, somebody who's assaulted or murdered somebody or something, you know, and that hits the news. It's on the news. I mean, everybody's scared. They lock their doors and oh yeah, there's an inmate creeping around here. He's a dangerous prisoner. He's loose in the town. He's loose and they can't find him. They're releasing hundreds of these people every day that are
yes.
in shape. Then those guys, but they don't say anything about it. You know, they're letting them loose, and they're turning them loose with I think it was $50 the first time, and the second time. If they go to the prison second time, they release them with nothing. You know, no place to go, no money, just out on the streets. What are they going to do?
They're going to resort to crime in order to survive.
So the recidivism rate is 75% over 3 years in this state.
What does that mean, recidivism?
That means that an inmate who is released from prison, within 3 years, 75% of them will commit another crime and be thrown back into prison. So what kind of sanity is that? That's nuts. It's totally nuts.
Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first half with Jerry Marzinski, and we're just getting started. Jerry, can you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you, and you know, if they wanted to share any of their stories with you?
Well, I have the I have a Facebook page. You know, I have the YouTube channel. I've got email, but I'm hesitant to give that out.
Yeah, I understand. So what we'll do is we'll put Jerry's Facebook information as well as his YouTube channel up on our dedicated website as well as our dedicated YouTube channel. We're just getting started, folks. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show with our very special guest, Jerry Marzinski. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.